One of the other things that people find very difficult to take in the Oval Office on March the 21st is the coaching that you gave Dean and Haldeman on how to deal with a grand jury without getting caught, and saying that perjury is a tough rap to prove, as you'd said earlier. Just be damn sure you say, "I don't remember, I can't recall." Is that the sort of conversation that ought to have been going on in the Oval Office, do you think?
I think that kind of advice is proper advice for one who, as I was at that time, beginning to put myself in the position of an attorney for the defense, something that I wish I hadn't felt I had the responsibility to do. But I would like the opportunity, when the question arises, to tell you why I felt as deeply as I did on that point. Every lawyer, when he talks to a witness who's going before a grand jury, says, be sure that you don't volunteer anything. Be sure if you have any question about anything, say that you don't recollect. Be sure that everything that you state, only the facts that you're absolutely sure of. Now, on the other hand, I didn't tell them to say, don't forget if you do remember. That then would be suborning perjury. I did not say that.
One of the things you repeated many times, but I suppose most memorably or most clearly on August the 15th, 1973, you said, if anyone at the White House or high up in my campaign had been involved in wrongdoing of any kind, I wanted the White House to take the lead in making that known. On March the 21st, I instructed Dean to write a complete report of all that he knew on the entire Watergate matter. Now, when one looks through the record of what had gone on just before and after March the 21st, on March the 17th, the written statement from Dean, you asked for a self-serving goddamn statement denying culpability of principal figures. When he told you that the original Liddy plan had involved bugging, you told him to omit that fact in his document and state the plan was for a totally legal intelligence operation. March 20th, as I'm sure you know, you said you want a complete statement but make it very incomplete. On March the 21st, after his revelations to you, you say, understand, I don't want to get all that goddamn specific. And Ehrlichman and you, when you're talking on the 22nd, and he's talking the Dean report, he says, and the report says, nobody was involved. And there's several other quotes to the effect. Was that the Dean report that you described? It wasn't the same as what you described on August the 15th, was it?
Well, what you're leaving out, of course, which is in that same tape that you just quoted from, is a very, very significant statement. I said that John Dean should make a report. And I said, we have to have a statement. And then I went on to say, and if it opens doors, let it open doors. Now, with regard to the report being complete but incomplete, what I meant was this, very simply. I meant that he should state what he was sure of, what he knew. Because one day he would say one thing, another day he'd say something else. I didn't want him to answer, and you'll find that also in one of the tapes. I said, don't go into every charge that has been made. Go into only what you know. And particularly, go in hard on the fact which he had consistently repeated over and over again, no one in the White House is involved. But that's what I wanted him to do.
But then you have a discussion in the meeting with Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Mitchell, Dean, where you're deciding what the policy is going to be. Is it going to be a hangout, i.e. is it going to be the whole of the truth? And in the end, it's decided that it's going to be one of the great phrases of Watergate, a modified, limited hangout, which is why I suggest the other quotes that I've quoted to you are decisive. And then Ehrlichman goes on to say, I'm looking at the future. And he said, now, we've already know it's a modified limited hangout, and you can't have a modified limited version of the truth. I mean, it's obviously not going to be the whole of the truth. I am looking at the future, assuming some corner of this thing comes unstuck at some time. You, that's you, are in a position to say, look, that document I published is the document I relied on. That is the report I relied on. And you respond, that's right. Now, you've decided the document's going to be modified, it's going to be limited, and then you're going to rely on that document, and so you're going to better blame it on Dean. And it seems to me that that is consistent with all the quotes that I've quoted, and not the one door quote that you've quoted.
That's your opinion, and I have my opinion. Dean was sent to write a report. He worked on it. He certainly would have remembered a phrase that was, let me say, a lot more easy to understand than modified hangout, or whatever Ehrlichman said. He would remember, if it opens doors, it opens doors. I meant by that I was prepared to hear the worst as well as the good.
I still don't know, when you found about the things that Haldeman and Ehrlichman had done, that there is no evidence anywhere of a rebuke, but only of scenarios and excuses, etc. Nowhere do you say, we must get this information direct to whoever it is, the head of the Justice Department criminal investigation or whatever. And nowhere do you say to Haldeman and Ehrlichman, this is disgraceful conduct, and Haldeman admits a lot of it the next day, so you're not relying on Dean, you're fired.
Well, could I take my time now to address that question? I think it will be very useful to you know what I was going through. It wasn't a very easy time. I think my daughter Tricia once said that there really wasn't a happy time in the White House, except in a personal sense, after April 30th, when Haldeman and Ehrlichman left. I'll never forget when I heard that on April 15 from Henry Peterson that they ought to resign, and Kleindienst thought they ought to resign. And it took me 2 weeks. I frankly agreed, incidentally, in my own mind, that they had to go on the basis of the evidence that had been presented. But I didn't tell them that at that point. When I say I agreed with it, I didn't fully reach that conclusion because I still wanted to give them a chance to survive. So it took me 2 weeks to work it out. Tortuous, long sessions. You got hours and hours of talks with them, which they resisted. We don't need to go through all that agony. Then I remember the day at Camp David when they came up. Haldeman came in first. He's standing as he usually does. Not a dramatic Nazi stormtrooper, but just a decent, respected, crew-cut guy. That's the way Haldeman was. Splendid man. And he says, I disagree with your decision totally. He said, I think it's going, eventually, you're going to live to regret it, but I will. Ehrlichman then came in. I knew that Ehrlichman was bitter because he felt very strongly he shouldn't resign, although he'd even indicated that Haldeman should go and maybe he should stay. And I took Ehrlichman out on the porch at Aspen. You've never been to Aspen, I suppose. That's the presidential cabin at Camp David, and it was springtime. The tulips had just come out. I never forget. We looked out across. It was one of those gorgeous days when no clouds were on the mountain. And I was pretty emotionally wrought up. And I remember that I could just hardly bring myself to tell Ehrlichman that he had to go because I knew he was going to resist it. I said, you know, John, when I went to bed last night, he said, I almost prayed I wouldn't wake up this morning. Well, it's an emotional moment. I think there were tears in her eyes, both of us. He says, don't say that. We went back in. They agreed to leave. And so it was late, but I did it. I cut off one arm, then cut off the other arm. Now, I can be faulted. I recognize it. Maybe I defended them too long. Maybe I tried to help them too much. But I was concerned about them. I was concerned about their families. I felt that they and their hearts felt they were not guilty. I felt they ought to have a chance at least to prove that they were not guilty. And I didn't want to be in the position of just sawing them off in that way. And I suppose you could sum it all up the way one of your British prime ministers summed it up, Gladstone, when he said that the first requirement for a prime minister is to be a good butcher. Well, I think the great story, as far as summary of Watergate is concerned, I did some of the big things rather well. I screwed up terribly on what was a little thing and became a big thing, but I will have to admit I wasn't a good butcher.
Would you go further than mistakes? That you've explained how you got caught up in this thing. You've explained your motives. I don't want to quibble about any of that. But just coming to the sheer substance, would you go further than mistakes? The word that seems not enough for people to understand.
What word would you express?
My goodness, that's a... I think that there are three things, since you asked me, I would like to hear you say. I think the American people would like to hear you say. One is, there was probably more than mistakes. There was wrongdoing, whether it was a crime or not. Yes, it may have been a crime too. Secondly, I did, and I'm saying this without questioning the motives, right? I did abuse the power I had as president, or not fulfill the totality of the oath of office. That's the second thing. And thirdly, I put the American people through 2 years of needless agony, and I apologize for that. And I say that, you've explained your motives, I think those are the categories. And I know how difficult it is for anyone, and most of all you, but I think that people need to hear it, and I think unless you say it, you're going to be haunted for the rest of your life.
I well remember that when I let Haldeman and Ehrlichman know that they were to resign, that I had Ray Price bring in the final draft of the speech that I was to make the next night. And I said to him, Ray, I said, if you think I ought to resign, I said, put that in too, because I feel responsible. Even though I did not feel that I had engaged in these activities consciously, insofar as the knowledge of or participation in the break-in, the approval of hush money, the approval of clemency, etc., the various charges that have been made. Well, he didn't put it in. I think some of my mistakes that I regret most deeply came with the statements that I made afterwards. Some of those statements were misleading. I said things that were not true. Most of them were fundamentally true on the big issues, but without going as far as I should have gone and saying perhaps that I had considered other things, well, but had not done them.
You mean
and for all those things, I have a very deep regret.
You got caught up in something, yeah, and then it snowballed.
It snowballed. And it was my fault. I'm not blaming anybody else. So I'm simply saying to you that as far as I'm concerned, I not only regret it, I indicated my own beliefs in this matter. Yeah. When I resigned, people didn't think it was enough to admit mistakes, fine. If they want me to get down and grovel on the floor, no, never. Because I don't believe I should. On the other hand, there are some friends who say, just face them down. There was a conspiracy to get you. There may have been. I don't know what the CIA had to do. Some of their shenanigans have yet to be told, according to a book I read recently. I don't know what was going on in some Republican, some Democratic circles as far as the so-called impeachment lobby was concerned. However, I don't go with the idea that that what brought me down was a coup, a conspiracy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I brought myself down. I gave them a sword, and they stuck it in, and they twisted it with relish. And I guess if I'd been in their position, I'd have done the same thing.
But what I'm really saying is that, in addition to the untrue statements that you've mentioned, could you just say, with conviction, I mean, not because I want you to say it, that you did do some covering up?
No, I again respectfully will not quibble with you about the use of the terms. However, before using the term, I think it's very important for me to make clear what I did not do and what I did do. And then I will answer your question quite directly. I did not, in the first place, commit the crime of obstruction of justice, because I did not have the motive required for the commission of that crime.
We've had our discussion.
The lawyers can argue
that.
I disagree
on that.
I did not commit, in my view, an impeachable offense. Now, the House has ruled overwhelmingly that I did. Of course, that was only an indictment, and it would have to be tried in the Senate. I might have won, I might have lost. But even if I had won in the Senate by a vote or two, I would have been crippled. And in any event, for 6 months, the country couldn't afford having the president in the dock in the United States Senate. And there can never be an impeachment in the future in this country without a president voluntarily impeaching himself. I have impeached myself. That speaks for itself.
How do you mean I have impeached myself?
By resigning. That was a voluntary impeachment. And now what does that mean in terms of whether you're wanting me to say that I am participated in an illegal cover-up? No. Now, when you come to the period, and this is the critical period, when you come to the period of March 21st on, when Dean gave his legal opinion that certain things, actions taken by Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Mitchell, etc., and even by himself, amounted to a legal cover-up and so forth, then I was in a very different position. And during that period, I will admit that I started acting as lawyer for their defense. I will admit that acting as lawyer for their defense, I was not prosecuting the case. I will admit that during that period, rather than acting primarily in my role as the chief and law enforcement officer of the United States of America, or at least with responsibility for law enforcement, because the Attorney General is the chief law enforcement officer, but as the one with the chief responsibility for seeing that the laws of the United States are enforced, that I did not meet that responsibility. And to the extent that I did not meet that responsibility, to the extent that within the law, and in some cases going right to the edge of the law in trying to advise Ehrlichman and Haldeman and all the rest as to how best to present their cases, because I thought they were legally innocent, that I came to the edge. And under the circumstances, I would have to say that a reasonable person could call that a cover-up. I didn't think of it as a cover-up. I didn't intend it to cover up. Now we come down to the key point. And let me answer it in my own way about how do I feel about the American people? I mean, whether I should have resigned earlier or what I should say to them now. I had a lot of difficult meetings those last days before I resigned. And the most difficult one, and the only one where I broke into tears, frankly, except for that very brief session with Ehrlichman up at Camp David. It was the first time I cried since Eisenhower died. I met with all of my key supporters just a half hour before going on television. For 25 minutes, we all sat around the Oval Office, men that I'd come to Congress with, Democrats and Republicans, about half and half, wonderful men. And at the very end, after saying, well, thank you for all your support during these tough years, thank you for the, particularly for what you've done to help us end the draft, bring home the POWs, and have a chance for building a generation of peace, which I could see the dream that I had possibly being shattered. And thank you for your friendship, little acts of friendship over the years, you know, you sort of remembering you with a birthday card and the rest. Then suddenly you haven't got much more to say, and half the people around the table were crying. Les Ahrens, Illinois, bless him, he was just shaking, sobbing. And I just can't stand seeing somebody else cry. And that ended it for me. And I sort of cracked up. Started to cry, pushed my chair back, and then I blurted it out. And I said, I'm sorry. I just hope I haven't let you down. Well, when I said, I just hope I haven't let you down, that said it all. I had. I let down my friends. I let down the country. I let down our system of government and the dreams of all those young people that ought to get into government, but will think it's all too corrupt and the rest. Most of all, I let down an opportunity that I would have had for 2.5 more years to proceed on the great projects and programs for building a lasting peace, which has been my dream, as you know, from our first interview in 1968, before I had any thought I might even win that year. I didn't tell you I didn't think I might win, but I wasn't sure. Yep, I let the American people down. And I have to carry that burden with me for the rest of my life. My political life is over. I will never yet, never again, have an opportunity to serve in any official position. Maybe I can give a little advice from time to time. And so I can only say that in answer to your question, that while technically I did not commit a crime, an impeachable offense, these are legalisms. As far as the handling of this matter is concerned, it was so botched up. I made so many bad judgments. The worst ones, mistakes of the heart rather than the head, as I pointed out. But let me say,
A man in that top judge, top job, he's got to have a heart. But his head must always rule his heart.